and welcome to the Learning College. My name is Alex Linder, and you can find this and everything we record at vnnforum.com. I usually also post links on pieville.net, our social medium, and as part of Kirksville Today, our daily digest from the White Point of View. Today we're going to resume Chapter 13, Volume 2, Thomas Dalton's translation of Adolf Hitler's Mein Kampf. So this will be the back half of Chapter 13. It's about 14, 15 pages, so about ordinary length. Let's just get right to it. 13, the South Tyrol question. T-Y-R-O-L. Here I must recall, says Hitler, a special hobby horse that the Jew has ridden in recent years with amazing skill. South Tyrol. 192. Footnote 192. South Tyrol is a, and I'm not sure whether it's pronounced Tyrol or Tyrol, but anyway, it's a small area. As the footnote says, 192. South Tyrol is a semi-autonomous province in northern Italy, comprised primarily of German speakers. Current population is around 525,000. So some of the, when you see, for example, in the Winter Olympics, an Italian with a German name, it could well be from that area. So it's actually in Italy, but ethnically it's German. And Hitler says, this area is a special hobby horse the Jew has ridden in recent years with amazing skill. Yes, indeed, South Tyrol. The reason why I take up this question here is because I want to call to account that shameful rabble who relied on the forgetfulness and stupidity of large sections of our people and who stimulated a national indignation that is as foreign to the real character of our parliamentary swindlers as the idea of private property is to a magpie. Comes close to humor there. I would like to emphasize that I was one of those at the time when the fate of South Tyrol was being decided, that is, from August 1914 to November 1918, 4.5 years, who went where that place was being effectively defended, namely in the army. I did my share of fighting during those years, not merely to save South Tyrol from being lost, but also to save it, like every other German province, for the fatherland. For the fatherland. The parliamentary shysters took no part in that battle, but simply played party politics. On the contrary, we carried on the fight in the belief that a victorious outcome of the war would preserve South Tyrol for the German nation, while those loud-mouthed Effialtises agitated and plotted against victory until the fighting Siegfried succumbed to the stab in the back. Effialtises, 193 footnote, reads, Effialtis was a notorious traitor of ancient Greece, E-P-H-I-A-L-T-E-S. So he's calling the parliamentarians, who we know he hates, as backstabbers responsible for the loss in World War I. It was only natural that the lying inflammatory speeches of the parliamentarians on the Vienna Ballhaus plots or in front of the Munich Feldherrenhalle couldn't save South Tyrol for Germany. Only the fighting battalions at the front could do that. Those who broke up the front betrayed South Tyrol, as they did all other German districts. Anyone who believes that the South Tyrol question can be resolved today by protests, declarations, and organizational parades is either a completely exceptional scoundrel or merely a German Philistine. It must be made clear that we cannot recover lost territories by depending on solemn appeals to Almighty God or on pious hopes in a League of Nations, but only by force of arms. So the only remaining question is, who's ready to take up arms for the restoration of these lost territories? Concerning myself personally, I can state with a clear conscience that I would have enough courage to take part in a campaign for the victorious conquest of South Tyrol at the head of parliamentarian storm battalions consisting of parliamentarian big mouths and other party leaders along with the various state councillors. The devil knows that I would love to see a few shrapnel shells suddenly burst over this flaming protest demonstration. I think that if a fox were to break into a hen house, the rush to safety would be no quicker than the scurrying of such a wonderful protest coalition, in apostrophes. So he's making fun of the cowardice of the parliamentarians, the loudmouths. The vilest part of all this is that these gentlemen themselves don't believe that anything can be achieved in this way. Each one of them knows very well the impossibility and ineffectiveness of their action. They do it only because it's easier now to babble about the restoration of South Tyrol than it was to fight for keeping it. Everyone plays their part. In those days, we sacrificed our blood, and today this crowd merely sharpens their beaks. It's particularly interesting to note today how Viennese legitimist circles bristle with work for the restoration of South Tyrol. 7 years ago, their noble and illustrious monarchy helped, by an act of perjury and treason, to make it possible for the victorious World Coalition to take away South Tyrol. At that time, these circles supported the perfidious dynasty and didn't give a damn about South Tyrol or any other province. Naturally, it's easier today to take up the fight for this territory, since the present struggle is waged only with, intellectual weapons. And it's easier to talk yourself hoarse in a protest meeting out of noble, heartfelt indignation, or to wear down your fingers in the writing of a newspaper article, than, say, to blow up a bridge during the occupation of the Ruhr. So Hitler respects writing, but it is in no way a replacement, substitute, or equal to actual physical fighting. I think that comes through extremely strongly in every page where he touches on anything near these questions in this two-volume book. Writing ain't fighting. It's a secondary, a wifely almost, support structure. 1314, who betrayed South Tyrol? There's a typo in there. I'm missing the R in the subsection title. Who betrayed South Tyrol? And again, the titles of the subsection, the breaking of it into sections even, is due to Dalton. It's obvious why certain circles have made the South Tyrol question the pivot of German-Italian relations during the past few years. And remember, this chapter is all about foreign policy, and in the first segment, which was last time and was recording 32, we're now in recording 33. In 32, we heard him conclude that only England and Italy were potential alliance partners, because England, wanting to maintain the balance of power in the continent as it had done for hundreds of years, now that Germany had been utterly defeated, would not want to see it actually disappear, but needs it to be a little strengthened as a counterweight to France, in line with its interests and its traditional historical policy. And the other nation that he thought had an interest in the same thing for slightly different reason, but there was an overlap between Germany and Italy in building up against France. They had a common enemy in France, let's say. So, or a common interest as pertained to the French. So those are the two nations that he said Germany should be looking to make an alliance with, England and Italy, after World War I. It's obvious why certain circles have made the South Tyrol question the pivot of German-Italian relations during the past few years. Jews and Habsburg legitimists, those people who want that monarchy that he hated, are greatly interested in preventing Germany from pursuing an alliance policy that might one day lead to the resurgence of a free German fatherland. It isn't out of a love for South Tyrol that they raise this fuss, which hurts instead of helps, but through fear of a possible German-Italian agreement. The general hypocritical and slanderous tendencies of these circles explains how they calmly and brazenly attempt to make it appear that we have betrayed South Tyrol. It must be said to these gentlemen, South Tyrol was betrayed, first, by every German of sound limbs who did not offer himself for the service to his fatherland at the front during the years 1914 to 1918. Second, by every man who, during those years, didn't help to reinforce the national body's power of resistance so as to enable the country to carry through the fight to the very end. Third, South Tyrol was betrayed by everyone who took part in the November Revolution, either directly by his act or indirectly by a cowardly toleration of it, and thus broke the sole weapon that could have saved South Tyrol. And fourth, South Tyrol was betrayed by those parties and their followers who signed the disgraceful treaties of Versailles and Saint-Germain. Yes, indeed, that's how things stand, my brave lip service gentlemen. Today I am guided only by a sober recognition of the fact that the lost territories cannot be won back by the sharpened tongues of parliamentary big mouths, but only by the sharpened sword. In other words, through a bloody fight. Now I have no hesitation in saying that today, once the die has been cast, it's not only impossible to win back South Tyrol through a war, but I should definitely reject it, because I'm convinced that it would not be possible to arouse the German people's national enthusiasm over this question to the degree necessary for success. On the contrary, I believe that if we have to shed blood once again, it would be criminal to do so for the sake of liberating 200,000 Germans when more than 7 million next door are suffering under foreign domination, and a vital artery of the German nation has become a playground for hordes of African niggers. He's talking about the Ruhr occupation. If the German nation wants to end a condition that threatens to root it out of Europe, it mustn't fall prey to errors of the pre-war period and make enemies of God and the world, but rather it must determine the most dangerous enemy and then concentrate all its power to strike at it. And if this victory is obtained through sacrifices elsewhere, future generations won't condemn us. In light of the miseries and anxieties that led us to make such a bitter decision, they will more clearly recognize the brilliancy of our success. Once again, we must always be guided by the fundamental principle that the political independence and power of the motherland must first be restored if we are to win back lost provinces of the Reich. Hence, the first task of powerful leadership in foreign affairs is to make this possible by a wise alliance policy. We National Socialists must particularly guard against being dragged along by Jewish-led bourgeois patriots in word only. Woe to us if, instead of preparing for the oncoming struggle, our movement also busied itself in mere protest. It was the fantastic idea of a Nibelungen alliance with the cadaver of the Habsburg state that brought about Germany's ruin. Footnote 194. 194, a Nibelungen alliance refers to any such policy based on naivete and misplaced trust. A Nibelungen alliance, reference to allusion to Wagner's plays or his operas. It was the fantastic idea of a Nibelungen alliance with the cadaver of the Habsburg state, which completely described as growing up in Vienna in Volume 1, that brought about Germany's ruin. And the alliance between Italy and Austria-Hungary and Germany, he was very much against for the reasons he gave. Fantastic sentimentality in dealing with today's foreign policy possibilities would be the best means of forever preventing our revival. 1315, three questions on an alliance policy. Here it is necessary for me to briefly respond to objections to the three questions I have raised. First, whether it's even possible to form an alliance with present-day Germany, whose weakness is so visible to all. Second, whether the enemy nations can change their attitude towards Germany, is meaning England. And third, whether Jewish influence is stronger than all understanding or goodwill, and thus will frustrate and nullify all plans. I think I've sufficiently discussed one half of the first question. Of course, no one will enter into an alliance with present-day Germany. No power in the world would link its destiny with a state whose government would destroy all confidence. Regarding the attempt by many of our compatriots to explain the government's conduct by referring to our people's woeful mentality and thus to excuse it, one must strongly object to this view. Certainly the lack of our people's character for the last 6 years is deeply distressing. Their indifference toward the most urgent national necessities has been crushing, and their cowardice has sometimes cried out to high heaven. But one must never forget we are dealing with a people who gave to the world, a few years earlier, an admirable example of the highest human qualities. From the first days of August 1914 to the end of the tremendous struggle between nations, no people on earth gave better proof of manly courage, tenacity, and patient endurance than this German people who today have become so pathetic. No one will dare to assert that the present lack of character is typical of our people. What we have to endure today, among us and around us is due only to the horrible, maddening, and infuriating influence of that treasonous deed of 9 November 1918. More than ever before, the poet's word is true. Evil begets evil. But even in this time, our people haven't entirely lost those fundamentally sound qualities. They slumber in the depths, and sometimes we can see these virtues, like shining lights in a cloudy firmament, that a future Germany will someday recall as the first signs of a revival. More than once, thousands and thousands of young Germans have come forth and resolved to sacrifice their young lives on the altar of the fatherland, just as they did in 1914. Millions of men have resumed work wholeheartedly and zealously, as if the destructive revolution had never occurred. The blacksmith is at his anvil once again. The farmer drives his plow. The scholar is in his study, all with the same devotion to duty. Our oppression at the hands of our enemies is no longer taken, as it formerly was, with laughter, but rather with bitter and angry faces. Undoubtedly, a great change of attitude has taken place. None of this has yet taken the shape of a rebirth in our national conception of political power and self-preservation, and the blame falls to those who, since 1918, and less by the grace of heaven than self-appointment, have governed our people to death. Yes, indeed. If anyone accuses our people today, he should be asked, what's being done to help them? What of the feeble support that the people give to any governmental decisions, decisions that, in fact, hardly exist? Is this a sign of our lack of vitality, or is it not a sign of the complete failure of the management of this valuable trust? What have our governments done to reawaken in the people a proud spirit of self-assertion, manly defiance, and righteous hatred? 1316. Neglected exploitation of the Versailles Treaty. In 1919, when the peace treaty was imposed on the German people, there were grounds for hoping that this instrument of unrestricted oppression would help to reinforce the outcry for German freedom. Peace treaties whose demands fall like a whiplash on the people turn out, not infrequently, to be the signal of a future uprising. What one could have done with this peace treaty of Versailles! Exclamation point. In the hands of a willing government, this instrument of unlimited blackmail and shameful humiliation could have aroused nationalist passion to its highest pitch. A well-directed system of propaganda could have utilized this sadist cruelty to change the people's indifference into indignation, and then that indignation into the most blazing fury. Each point could have been burned into the minds and hearts of this people until 60 million heads, both men and women, would find their souls aflame with a common feeling of hatred and shame, and a torrent of fire would burst forth, and one common cry would arise from it, hard as steel. Then the people would cry, "To arms again!" Yes, indeed, that's what such a peace treaty can do. Its boundless oppression and impudent demands are the greatest propaganda weapons for awakening the life spirit of a nation. Then, from the child's storybook to the last newspaper, and every theater and every cinema, every pillar and every open billboard must be placed into the service of this one great mission. Then the faint-hearted cry of our present-day social patriots, "Lord, make us free," would be transformed into an ardent prayer. Almighty God, bless our arms when the hour comes. Be just, as thou hast always been. Judge now if we deserve our freedom. Lord, bless our struggle. All this was neglected, and nothing was done. Who will be surprised now if our people are not such as they should be, or could be? If the rest of the world looks upon us only as a stooge, as an obedient dog that licks the hand that has just beaten him? Certainly our capacity for forming alliances with other nations is hampered by our own people, but much more by our governments. They, in their corruption, are guilty of the fact that, after 8 years of indescribable oppression, there exists so little will to freedom. In order that our nation may undertake an alliance policy, It must restore its prestige among other nations, and it must have an authoritative government that's not a handyman of foreign states and the taskmaster of its own people, but rather a herald of the national conscience. If our people had a government that saw this as its mission, 6 years would not have passed before a courageous Reich foreign policy would find an equally bold will among a people thirsting for freedom. Of course, he's describing exactly what he is going to bring and do and be. He knows what he's doing. You can tell that he believes he knows what he's doing. He never says, I'm the guy or I'm the one, but it's implicit in everything that he says. 1317, inversion of anti-German psychosis. The second objection, the difficulty of changing enemy nations into friendly allies, can be answered as follows. The general anti-German psychosis cultivated by war propaganda in other countries must inevitably continue to exist until there is a renaissance of a German will to self-preservation, such that the German Reich once again becomes a state that can play on the European chessboard, and with whom one can play. Remember, Volume 1, he specifically singled out and credited with genius English psychology behind English propaganda, painting absolute black and white and whipping the people to keep their will strong when they easily could have lost. Only when the government and the people are fit to undertake an alliance policy can one power or another, whose interests coincide with ours, think of changing public opinion through propaganda. Naturally, this will take years of clever and continuous work. Because a long period is needed to change public opinion, it's necessary to be cautious before undertaking such work. That is, one mustn't begin the task unless one is absolutely convinced of its value and that of the fruit it will bear in the future. One mustn't try to change national sentiment based on the empty bragging of a more or less brilliant foreign minister, but only if there is a tangible guarantee of value of the new orientation. But again, he's talking before TV, and TV now, they will try to change almost overnight, or literally overnight, they will try to change their propaganda tune. If one tack isn't working, they'll immediately switch to another. So TV really did change the game. But back in these times, when it was more newspapers, you had to move more slowly and make sure that you really did want to change and lose the work you'd built up demonizing Germany by now shifting to where, well, they're terrible, but you know, we may need to reach an agreement with them on this because it's in our interest to keep France down, that sort of thing. Otherwise, there could be a complete shattering of public opinion. It's like he's saying, it has to be simple, consistent, and clear, and repeated. And if you start doing back and forth and getting into shades of gray, or even doing a 180, it becomes very confusing to people. So we move on to page 682. The most reliable guarantee that can be given for the possibility of a future state alliance cannot be found in the bombastic phrases of some individual member of the government, but in the manifest stability of a definite and practical governmental tendency and in supportive public opinion. Faith in this will be strengthened all the more if the government, through propaganda, prepares to explain its efforts and secure public support for them, and if public opinion favorably reflects this governmental tendency. Therefore, a nation, in our situation, will be seen as a possible ally if government and public opinion are both united in the same enthusiastic determination to fight for freedom. This must be firmly established before any attempt can be made to change public opinion in other countries, which, for the sake of defending their interests, are inclined to travel alongside a partner who seems suitable to them, that is, to conclude an alliance. For this purpose, however, there's one more thing. Given that the task of bringing about a radical change in the spiritual attitude of a people calls for hard work, and that many don't understand it at first, it would be both stupid and criminal to commit mistakes that could be used as weapons by those who are opposed to such a change. 1318, concentration on one enemy. One enemy. One must recognize the fact that it takes a long time for a people to completely understand the inner purposes of a government, because one cannot explain the ultimate aims of preliminary political work. Rather, one either has to count on the blind faith of the masses, or on the intuitive instinct of the intellectually superior ruling class. But since many people lack this political insight, and since political considerations forbid a public explanation, a certain portion of intellectual leaders will always oppose new tendencies that can be viewed as mere experiments because they aren't easily grasped. Thus, the concerned conservative state elements begin to resist. For this reason, our highest duty is to keep any weapons from falling into the hands of those who would interfere with a mutual understanding among nations. This is especially so in our case, where we have to deal with the impractical and fantastic talk of our social patriots and petty bourgeoisie cafe politicians. The cry for a new battle fleet, the restoration of our colonies, etc., is simply nonsense and impractical, as any serious thinker would realize. These harmless and sometimes half-crazy spouters in the protest fight are serving the interests of our mortal enemy. Their words are exploited in England in a way that cannot be considered as advantageous to Germany. They squander their energies in futile demonstrations against God and the whole world, and they forget the fundamental principle that is a precondition for every success, namely, whatever you do, do it thoroughly. By howling against 5 or 10 states, we fail to concentrate all the forces of our will and physical strength for a blow to the heart of our bitterest enemy, and we sacrifice the possibility of strengthening ourselves through an alliance. Here, too, is a mission for the National Socialist Movement. It must teach our people to overlook the small things and focus on the great ones, do not become divided over minor issues, and to never forget that the object for which we fight today is the naked existence of our people, and that the sole enemy that we must confront is and remains that power which is robbing us of this existence. Some things may become hard to bear, but this is by no means an excuse for renouncing reason and for raising senseless outcries against the whole world instead of concentrating all our forces against the most deadly enemy. Concentrate against the most deadly enemy. 1319, reckoning with the traitors. Moreover, the German people have no moral right to complain of the manner in which the rest of the world acts towards them, as long as they themselves have not called to account those criminals who sold and betrayed their own country. We cannot hope to be taken very seriously if we indulge in long-range abuse and protests against England and Italy, and then allow those scoundrels to circulate undisturbed in our own country, who were in the pay of the enemy war propaganda, who took away our weapons and broke our moral backbone, and bartered away the Reich for 30 pieces of silver. The enemy only did what was expected, and we should learn from his conduct and actions. Anyone who cannot rise to the level of this outlook must realize that, otherwise, nothing would remain than to renounce the idea of any alliance policy in the future. If we cannot form an alliance with England because it has stolen our colonies, or with Italy because it has South Tyrol, or with Poland or Czechoslovakia, then there remains no one else in Europe except France, which incidentally robbed us of Alsace-Lorraine. There can scarcely be any doubt as to whether this serves the German people, but if one thing is in doubt, it's whether such an opinion comes from a mere simpleton or an astute adversary. When it comes to the activities of leaders, I always believe the latter. The leaders of these countries are not stupid. Hitler's no conservative. Those stupid liberals. A transformation in the individual psyche of those formerly enemy peoples whose true interests may well correspond with ours in the future may be possible if our state's internal strength and our will to self-preservation show that we could be worthy ally once again. We could be a worthy ally once again. Moreover, our incompetence and criminal conduct shouldn't provide grounds to be used by those who would oppose our alliance with former enemies. 1320, Fascist Italy and Jewry. The hardest to answer is the third question of the ones he posed at the start of this. Is it conceivable that those who represent the true interests of those alliance possible nations, England and Italy, could uphold their views against the will of the Jewish mortal enemy of free peoples and nation states? For example, could the forces of traditional British statesmanship break the disastrous Jewish influence or not? This question, as already said, is very difficult to answer. It depends on too many factors to form a conclusive judgment. In any case, one thing is certain. In one state, governmental power is so stabilized and is so absolutely at the service of the country's interests that one cannot speak of a real and effective obstruction of political necessities by international Jewish forces. The fight that fascist Italy is waging against the Jews' three principal weapons, though perhaps in the deepest sense unconsciously, but I don't believe this myself, furnishes the best proof that the poisonous fangs of this supra-state power, that's the Jews, bigger than a state, a global, right, international, supra, furnishes the best proof that the poisonous fangs of this supra-state power are being torn out, albeit indirectly. So they're not, maybe they're not specifically saying that they're going after Jews, but they're going after Jews. The prohibition of Freemason secret societies, the suppression of the supranational press, and the continuous demolition of international Marxism, together with the steady reinforcement of the fascist state concept, all this will, over the years, enable the Italian government to more and more serve the interests of the Italian people without regard to the hissing of the Jewish world hydra. 1321, England and Jewry. Things are harder in England. In that country of, quote, the freest democracy, the Jew exerts an almost unlimited dictatorship indirectly through the public opinion. Footnote 195. Jewish influence in Britain has been significant. This is a very long footnote. I'm going to give you some history, footnote 195. So he's saying Jews have a giant influence through indirectly through public opinion, footnote 195. And we're on page 685. Jewish influence in Britain has been significant ever since their emancipation there in 1858. Important early figures included Isaac Goldsmid, David Salomons, and Benjamin Disraeli. The Rothschild family established banking enterprises there already in the 1790s, and through their profits in the Napoleonic Wars in the early 1800s, gained considerable wealth and influence. By 1880, British writer Lawrence Oliphant could write of the Jews, quote, financial operations on the largest scale, and, quote, the powerful influence which they wield in the press of many countries, Lawrence Oliphant. He adds, quote, owing to the financial, political, and commercial importance to which the Jews have now attained, there is probably no one power in Europe that would prove so valuable an ally as this wealthy, powerful, cosmopolitan race. Parentheses 1880:503. A decade later, Oxford historian Goldwin Smith observed that, quote, almost without exception, the press throughout Europe is in Jewish hands and is largely produced from Jewish brains. International finance is captive to Jewish energy and skill. In England, the fall of the Barings Bank has left the lonely supremacy of the House of Rothschild unchallenged and unassailable. Judaism is now the great financial power in Europe. That is, it is the greatest power of all. They were saying that before 1900. That's a cite from 1893, pages 260 to 280. Winston Churchill was closely tied to Jewish influence from at least 1904. Martin Gilbert, himself a Jew, notes that Churchill's political opponents accused him, quote, of being in the pocket and even in the pay of wealthy Jews. Michael Makovsky, 2007-46, writes that Churchill, quote, came to count many of his father's wealthy Jewish friends as his own. Close quote. As Hitler was well aware, Britain sought and obtained the aid of world Jewry, quote-unquote, in fighting World War I. David Lloyd George was particularly eager to engage American Jews' assistance to draw on the neutral Americans. The end result was a, quote, contract with Jewry to offer them a Zionist homeland in Palestine if they would help England win the war. The contract was codified in the infamous Balfour Declaration of 1917. For details, see Dalton, 2013. In sum, Hitler was certainly correct. Jews did indeed have a virtual dictatorship over Britain in the 1920s. It continues to this day, says Thomas Dalton. Things are harder in England, in that country of the freest democracy. The Jew exerts an almost unlimited dictatorship, indirectly through public opinion, then the footnote. And yet, there is a perpetual struggle between advocates of British state interests and the proponents of Jewish world dictatorship. World dictatorship. After the war, it became clear for the first time how sharp this contrast is when British state leaders took one stand on the Japanese problem and the press took another. Just after the end of the war, the old mutual antipathy between America and Japan began to reappear. Naturally, the great European powers couldn't remain indifferent to this new war danger. Despite ties of kinship, there was a certain amount of jealousy in England over the growing importance of the American Union in all spheres of international economics and politics. The former colonial territory, child of a great mother, seemed about to become the new world master. It's quite understandable that today England should re-examine her old alliances, and that British statesmanship should look nervously to a point in time when it won't be said, Britain rules the seas, but rather, the seas for the American Union. The gigantic American state colossus, with its enormous wealth of virgin soil, is much harder to attack than an encircled German Reich. If the die were to be cast and an ultimate decision reached, England would be doomed if it stood alone. Therefore, they eagerly reach for the yellow fist and cling to an alliance that, from a racial viewpoint, is perhaps unpardonable, but from a political viewpoint, it represents the sole possibility of reinforcing Britain's world position in the face of the upsurging American continent. Despite a common struggle on the European battlefields, the English government did not conclude an alliance with their Asiatic partner, and the whole Jewish press jumped on this idea from behind. How is it possible that, up to 1918, Jewish organs championed the British struggle against the German Reich, and then suddenly became disloyal and went their own way? The destruction of Germany was not an English interest, but primarily a Jewish one, just as today the destruction of Japan less serves British interests than it does the broader wishes of the leaders of the anticipated Jewish world empire. While England endeavors to maintain its position in the world, the Jew organizes his attack for its conquest. He already sees the present European states as pliant tools in his hands, whether indirectly through the so-called Western democracy or in the form of direct domination by Russian Bolshevism. But it's not only the old world that he holds in his snare, rather the same fate holds for the new. Jews control the stock exchange forces of the American Union. I don't know why it calls it the American Union. 196, footnote. Jewish influence in America at the time went well beyond the stock exchange and almost certainly was more extensive than Hitler realized. Jewish population was rising rapidly from 0.5% of the country in 1880 to 2.9% by 1918. The partly Jewish Teddy Roosevelt became president in 1901 after the Jewish-inspired assassination of President William McKinley. Jewish bankers like Paul and Felix Warburg, Jacob Schiff, and Bernard Baruch exercised considerable influence. Jewish lawyers such as Oscar Straus, Louis Marshall, Henry Morgenthau Sr., Louis Brandeis, and Samuel Untermeyer all had substantial clout in finance and government. Such individuals were decisive in persuading Woodrow Wilson and Congress to enter World War I. Like Ford's people wrote a lot about this in The International Jew. For more information, see Dalton, 2013. So Hiller says, Jews control the stock exchange forces of the American Union, 196. Every year they increase their control over the labor force. In a nation of 120 million people, only very few, to their chagrin, remain fully independent. Footnote 197. The original first edition of this volume had the words, only a single great man, meaning Henry Ford, remains fully independent. Ford was a noted critic of Jewish influence in America and was long praised by Hitler for standing up to them. For further details on Ford's views, see Dalton, 2012. They show consummate skill in manipulating public opinion and using it as an instrument in the fight for their own future. Jewry's greatest heads see the pending fulfillment of the Old Testament prophecy about the great devouring of nations. Footnote 198. See, for example, Genesis 27:29. Let peoples serve you, and let nations bow down to you. Deuteronomy 15:6, you shall rule over many nations, and 28:10, they shall be afraid of you. Isaiah 60:10, foreigners shall build up your walls, and their king shall minister to you, that men may bring you the wealth of nations. And 61:5, you shall eat the wealth of nations. This is what you get when you're in a church. That's what you're signing up for. Among this great herd of denationalized colonial territories, one independent state could bring about the ruin of the whole structure at the last hour. A Bolshevik world cannot exist unless it encompasses everything. If only one state preserves its national strength and greatness, the Jewish satrapy world empire, like every other tyranny in the world, would have to succumb to the force of the nationalist idea. 1322. Japan and Jewry. Now, due to his thousand years of adaptation, the Jew knows very well that he can undermine European nations by racial bastardization, but that he could not subject an Asiatic national state like Japan to the same fate. Today he can mimic the ways of the German and the Englishman, the American and the Frenchman, but he has no means of approach to the yellow Asiatic. Therefore, he seeks to break the Japanese national state by using other such formations so that he may rid himself of a dangerous opponent before he transforms the last state power in his fist into a tyranny over the defenseless. In his millennial Jewish empire, he dreads a national Japanese state and therefore wants to destroy it before establishing his own dictatorship. And so he incites nations against Japan today as he once did against Germany. Thus, while British statesmen are still trying to establish an alliance with Japan, the British Jewish press is leading a fight against the ally and prepares for a war of destruction under the proclamation of democracy and by using the war cry, "Down with Japanese militarism and imperialism." That's how insubordinate the Jew has become in England today. And for this reason, the struggle against the Jewish world danger will begin there. Finally, the last section to end this chapter, 1323, our fight against the world enemy. And here again, the National Socialist movement has a tremendous task to fulfill. It must open our people's eyes in regard to foreign nations, and it must continually remind them of the true enemy of the present-day world. In place of hatred against Aryans, from whom we may be separated on almost every other ground, but with whom the bond of common blood and kindred civilization unite us, we must devote ourselves to arousing a general wrath against the maleficent enemy of mankind as the real author of all our sufferings. We must see to it that, at least in our country, the mortal enemy is recognized and that the fight against him may become a beacon of light toward brighter days, showing other nations the way of salvation for an embattled Aryan humanity. We must see to it that, at least in our own country, in Germany, the mortal enemy is recognized, the Jew, and that the fight against him may become a beacon of light toward brighter days, showing other nations the way of salvation for an embattled Aryan humanity. Finally, may reason be our guide and willpower our strength. May the sacred duty to act give us determination and may our faith be our supreme protection. And that's how chapter 13 ends. Some very frank stuff about, yeah, Jews are controlling these countries and doing all kinds of garbage and perverting their foreign policies. Looks like maybe Italy has got a grasp on it. He admired Mussolini and followed him in some things. And yeah, Jews are the number one enemy. They control the British press. They have a huge amount of control in America, and we must forthrightly name them and fight them. So that'll end chapter 13, which was mostly about foreign policy, if not entirely about it. And thanks for being with me today. This has been recording number 33. And I'll be back with you again real soon.